Good morning, this is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the September 12th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that has come your way the second, fourth Wednesday mornings of every month and every other fifth Wednesday since the first week of January 2001, in which you are now hearing at a new time. Hardly a day passes when there's not at least a single reference interference in our elections in 2016, as well as in the current cycle. Moreover, there seems to be not a day that goes by that Russia, and particularly its president, Vladimir Putin, is not blamed for some crime here or elsewhere. Congress even passed new sanctions on Russia for its alleged role in the near-deadly poisoning of the former Russian intelligence agent-turned-British spy, who, along with his daughter, were taken seriously ill after coming in contact with what the old world was told was a nerve agent developed in the old Soviet Union but never reportedly produced. There has, however, been nary a word in the mainstream media or in NPR about the interference in our elections and our internal political processes of a close ally of the United States that has been doing both for years, most of it in plain sight. More accurately, some of this interference has been reported, but not identified as such in the media, since, although completely unwarranted, it has become an omnipresent, accepted part of our national political life. I'm referring, as you may have guessed, to the actions of Israel and its supporters in the United States, whose power over President Trump and the present Congress has far surpassed everything that we have experienced under any prior administration. That itself has been excessive for decades, and considering that Israel is a foreign country and that the United States is, or at least claims to be, a sovereign nation. Despite being so germane to all U.S. actions in the Middle East, this subject has long been considered taboo by the mainstream media and the leading alternatives, which also demonstrably cater to the whims of Israel's American supporters. Not being one of them and believing the subject to be of vital interest and importance to you, our listeners, and to the country, I have gone out of my way over the years to discuss this tender subject without fears. That will continue today at 20 minutes past the hour, when I'll be speaking again with former CIA case officer Phil Giraldi, one of the foremost experts on Israel's interference in the workings of the U.S. body politic. We'll be discussing two articles that Phil has written on the subject for the UNS Review over the last month. One, Why Confronting Israel is Important, and Israel's Fifth Column, Exercising Control from Within the Government. You can tell this from the titles that Phil Giraldi pulls no punches, so stay tuned for that. Yesterday, September 11th, marked the 18th anniversary of what is commonly memorialized as 9/11. Although there were tragedies that morning at four locations, the one most remembered in the minds of the public was the collapse of the World Trade Center's towers in New York City and the 2,600 dead following their being hit by two domestic airliners allegedly hijacked by members of Al-Qaeda. The subsequent collapse of nearby Building 7 in the same complex, which was not hit by anything but was ordered pulled or taken down by the Trade Center's owner, Larry Silverstein, has led to questioning of who was behind the attack and how it was carried out, stimulating controversies that are still going strong and circulating over the Internet while being totally ignored by the mainstream media. The man who we are told confessed to masterminding the attack, Pakistani-born Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was arrested there in 2003, taken to a secret black site in Poland, where he was reportedly waterboarded 183 times. After that, he began to quote-unquote cooperate, according to the New York Times article from 2008. He was subsequently shipped to Guantanamo, where in March 2007, after 6 months of detention and more alleged torture, he confessed to not only masterminding the September 11th attacks, but the Richard Reed shoe bombing, attempt to blow up an airliner over the Atlantic, the Bali nightclub bombing in Indonesia, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and a number of other foiled attacks, 31 in all. ABC News had been told by CIA officials that, quote, Mohammed lasted the longest underwater boarding, 2.5 minutes before beginning to talk, end quote. Well, legal experts say this could taint all his statements, which may explain why he and his four alleged accomplices will never be brought to trial. Meanwhile, the war the Bush administration launched in Afghanistan in response, and the numbers of Afghans who have died there dwarfs the number who perished at the World Trade Center. Monday's New York Times, in an article describing a wave of successful Taliban attacks against Afghan military and police installations, noted that in the first 10 months of 2016 alone, 6,785 Afghan police and soldiers had been killed by the Taliban, an average of more than 20 a day. Since then, according to the paper, the U.S. military has classified the casualty figures as secret at the request of the Afghan government. Meanwhile, as part of the continuum that began with the Bush administration's response to the events of 9/11, a shooting war between Russia and the U.S. may be closer than ever before. The site, not surprisingly, is Syria. On Sunday evening, as Russian and Syrian warplanes continued bombing raids over al-Qaeda-held Idlib, the Wall Street Journal, citing unnamed U.S. officials, claimed that, quote, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria has approved the use of chlorine gas in an offensive against the country's last major rebel stronghold, end quote. How they knew this, the article doesn't say, but the U.S. has repeatedly accused the Syrians of using chemical weapons even when none had been found on the scene, as Robert Falk of the London Independent described on Takes on the World in June when he learned in the Syrian town of Douma that what the U.S. and Western press had reported as a chlorine attack in that city was denied by the residents with whom he spoke. Well, this morning on NPR, they say some official organization has said it was chlorine, so who's to say? Well, moreover, there have been a number of reports from reliable sources through the Syrian war that outside forces such as ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, were in possession of chemical weapons and were likely using them, anticipating correctly, as it turned out, that the Syrian government would get the blame. This is a setup in Idlib to watch for. The Wall Street Journal story broke after reports had circulated that the Russian Navy and Air Force had staged a week of large-scale military exercises in the Mediterranean coast off Syria. Footage released by Russia's defense ministry showed Marine Special Forces landing on the shore of Syria's Latakia province under the cover of dozens of Russian combat aircraft. More than two dozen battleships reportedly participated in the exercise, as well as three of Russia's newest frigates, which practiced launching anti-ship missiles. In the air, Tu-160 Blackjack bombers and long-range Tu-142 Bear submarine hunters simulated missile launches. At the same time, Karen DeYoung reported in the September 6th Washington Post that, according to State Department officials, President Trump, who just 5 months ago said he wanted to get out of Syria and bring U.S. troops home soon, has agreed to a new strategy that indefinitely extends the military effort there while launching a major diplomatic push to achieve American objectives. Quote, although the military campaign against the Islamic State has been nearly completed, she writes, the administration has redefined its goals to include the exit of all Iranian military and proxy forces from Syria and establishment of a stable, non-threatening government acceptable to all Syrians and the international community, end quote. In other words, what Washington is gunning for in Syria is another regime change. She goes on to quote James Jeffrey, who she describes as, quote, a retired senior Foreign Service officer who last month was named Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's representative for Syrian engagement, as saying, quote, the new policy is we're no longer pulling out by the end of the year. Jeffrey said U.S. forces are to remain in the country to ensure an Iranian departure and the enduring defeat of the Islamic State. That means we're not in a hurry, he said. Asked whether Trump had signed off on what he called a, quote, a more active approach, Jeffrey said, I'm confident the president is on board with this, end quote. Jeffrey declined to describe any new military mission, wrote the Post Karen Young. But he emphasized what he said would be, quote, a major diplomatic initiative in the UN and elsewhere, and the use of economic tools, presumably including more sanctions on Iran and Russia, and the stated U.S. refusal to fund reconstruction in Assad-controlled Syria. But, noted Karen Young, the more activist policies of Jeffrey outlined, and only in vague terms, could increase the likelihood of a direct confrontation with Iran and potentially with Russia. What the Washington Post Karen Young does not mention is that for the past 5 years, James Jeffrey has been a, quote, distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And, where I'm quoting from its website, he, quote, he focused on U.S. diplomatic and military strategy in the Middle East with emphasis on Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, end quote. The Washington Institute is a major pro-Israel think tank formed by AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, in 1985, not to lobby on Israel's behalf, but to make policy on Israel's behalf, and the record shows that it has done that. Clearly, it has enhanced Israel's ability to enter into the inner circles of U.S. foreign policy and shape it in a manner that satisfies the agenda of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The open-ended vote by Congress after the events of 9/11 to allow President George W. Bush to take whatever military action he believed necessary anywhere in the world against al-Qaeda has been used as justification for the U.S. military presence in Syria, although the evidence shows that in Syria, the U.S. has been allied with al-Qaeda's affiliate, the al-Nusra Front, from its inception. That makes the continuing presence of the U.S. military a violation of the War Powers Act, passed under the presidency of Richard Nixon, designed to limit the powers of the president from sending U.S. troops into combat without congressional approval. The maximum time the president can do that under the act is 6 months, after which he must go to Congress or the troops must be withdrawn. But no matter who is the president and what party she or he represents, Congress has proved spineless, and Syria is a classic case. At the same time, a handful of liberal Democrats who are reluctant to invoke the War Powers Act regarding Syria are ready to do so for Yemen, which is a good and necessary thing because the active U.S. support for the war being waged by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates could not continue without critical support, which includes in-air refueling of Saudi aircraft and providing targeting intelligence. Last Thursday, a group of House Democrats, including Ro Khanna of California's Silicon Valley, Adam Smith from Washington, Mark Pocan from Wisconsin, who you hear on the Tom Hartman program, and Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, announced that this month they would introduce legislation invoking the War Powers Resolution, forcing a vote on ending what they assert is unconstitutional U.S. participation in the biblically catastrophic Saudi war in Yemen, and would seek Republican co-sponsors and support in doing so. They offered a number of reasons why this should happen now, the first of which that this U.S.-backed Saudi-United Emirate war in Yemen has created the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. As the congressman noted, the people of Yemen now face the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe, where 22 million people require humanitarian assistance and almost 18 million lack access to food, largely due to the Saudi war and blockade. And that they say there is no prospect this war will end until the U.S. pulls out of its participation. They're asking their voters to ask representatives to sign on the legislation when it is entered into the House. Finally, following Netanyahu's agenda, the Trump administration has not only ended U.S. funding for UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency set up to assist Palestinians made refugees by Israel's ethnic cleansing of their country in 1948, the White House believes there's a right to determine who is qualified for refugee status. Under no circumstances, according to Trump, would any Palestinian have a right to return to what was once Palestine, despite international law and UN resolution passed in 1948 saying otherwise. Moreover, on Monday, John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, declared that because of the defeat of the Palestinian Authority, refusal of the Palestinian Authority to meet with U.S. officials as a result of Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and because against Washington's wishes, the Palestinian Authority filed a complaint against Israel with the International Criminal Court in The Hague, the Washington office of the PLO will be closed. In a speech on Monday, Bolton threatened the international court with sanctions if it pursues investigations of the U.S. and Israel, which could include barring judges and prosecutors from entering the United States, as well as freezing their U.S. assets if they have any. If the court comes after us, Israel, or other allies, we will not sit quietly, said Bolton. Sanctioning the International Criminal Court? Well, clearly the inmates have taken over the asylum. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.